Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and you are very welcome to this week's edition of the Group Chat from Virgin Media News. I am political correspondent Gavin Riley, joined in studio, as ever, by news correspondents Zara King and Richard Chambers. Guys, hello.
How are you? Going?
You had a very busy Tuesday night.
We did. We were hosting the Irish Podcast Awards, which was actually lovely to be asked.
Good stuff.
Very nice.
You were celebrate the industry and all.
I was, yeah, something else going on, but thankfully all good on that front. Had you a good evening?
I really enjoyed it, actually, Richard. Did you enjoy it? It was good fun.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Some very worthy winners and, some really great podcasts. Actually, it was great for even just, finding new podcasts to listen to. I mean, just the depth and breadth of different types of podcasts which are out there. It was really good. Yeah,
good.
Really
nice to have like kind of a showcase of it because it's such a rich little field out there at the moment of so much content. And always grateful that people choose to spend some of their time with us as well.
And there was 26 awards actually, and we flew through them. I think we got them all given out in an hour, which honestly, I think
we're very efficient.
Was very efficient.
We are very efficient.
There are other things to be doing with your Tuesday evening, so you kind of get this all done. But exactly. No, a nice way to spend a Tuesday night. Richard, you had a really interesting weekend as well because you spent a lot of time with some. At a very emotionally charged Dublin airport.
Yeah, it was an incredible weekend. One of my favourite weekends now in the course of work and just outside of work I've had in a long, long time. Ibrahim and his family made it back, as well as a lot of other families coming from Gaza, finally back home. And yeah, it was just incredible. Great to see him in the flesh. It was kind of like a nice to meet you old friend sort of thing. You've been friends with somebody for ages and you've had like conversations at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with them sometimes, and you never know if you're going to hear from them again or let alone ever see them. So to see him walking through the airport doors was kind of incredible. Well, to be there with his family as well when it happened, it was a whirlwind then of a weekend, really, as it all transpired. But it was just really uplifting stuff. Yeah. In the middle of so much darkness.
Really. Well, it must have really felt that way because it was only this time last week where you were talking about some of the messages you'd had with Ibrahim and his family when there was the risk of the communications blackouts, and you openly said there were times where he was going to send you his GPS coordinates so that if things went dark and there was no sign, this is where he and his family would be covered. And then within a matter of days of sharing that with us, there he is in the arrivals hall at Dublin Airport. Like, what a roller coaster that is.
It was wild, yeah. And like, he was delighted to be able to just, share a story, not through a smartphone for a change.
Yeah.
So, met him at the airport. He wanted to go straight into the national demonstration in city centre. So literally straight off the plane, straight into the demonstration. And then after that, I gave him a spin back into to his house for an interview with us for Virgin Media, which was really lovely.
Chatty taxi driver?
I was actually, yeah. And it's so interesting because his dad-in-law who came back with him from Gaza, a lot of the stuff on the way in was just kind of new and novel to him in terms of things like even average speed cameras in Dublin Port Tunnel, stuff you don't have in Gaza, sat-nav and things like that. And it just brings just how different a world Gaza is to the rest of the world as a result of sanctions and as a result of blockades and multiple wars at this point. But we had a lovely welcome by the Alaga family when we turned up at the house. Myself and Conan, the cameraman, had a great outfit.
All this time,
pretty much like the family, like his brother and his parents live up the way.
Okay,
so they were obviously able to come in and do a few bits and bobs. But it was great. We have the full extended interview. A lot of people reacting to what Ibrahim said to us over the weekend. It's been actually supercharged sharing from around the world today by people who are very much on the Palestinian issue. Just about particularly around he talked about when he met Irish diplomats when the family crossed into Rafah for the first time. And the first thing the Irish diplomats had for them was food and water. And he gave Sammy, his eldest boy, an 8-year-old boy, a bottle of water to drink. And Sammy turned to him and asked, "Am I okay? Am I allowed to drink anymore?" Because obviously in the house, they had to ration water and it wasn't clean water anyway. And that's something which was, deeply affecting. The fact that, you know, it has had a huge impact on Ibrahim and on Hamida, his wife.
Considerate little boy that he would think to of others not to drink all of it.
That's, and it is, and that's the thing. And Sammy, Ibrahim speaks in the interview at length about, you know, how Sammy has been affected. Sammy came into us actually in Virgin Media for a look around.
He's going to be a new anchor, I think.
Sammy,
he's going to be joining us by Christmas.
Sammy is a remarkable kid. Sammy is, he is, dreams of being a journalist, and he has done for weeks. And I remember saying weeks ago, to him when he was in Gaza, through his dad, like, if you want to come in, we can show you around the place once you're back. And this is something he's clearly held on to. And on Saturday evening, Ibrahim mentioned it to Sammy again. It's like, do you remember Richard said you might come in and you might have a look at the TV studio? And he was like,
my God, he has.
So I'm coming out tomorrow. Already didn't leave Ibrahim alone.
Announced straight away that he was coming
out. Didn't leave him alone until he was going out. And he was at a great time. There wasn't a camera in here. He hadn't pushed around. He sat in Tommy Martin's seat for Champions League footage. It's great to see them back. It is a very difficult situation for them. Ibrahim found out that another cousin of his was killed. Literally on the morning he arrived back. I would really encourage people to listen to the full interview, which we're going to release, I think, on Friday morning, probably on the podcast feed. Particularly, just to leave it at this, there's also a very interesting story which Ibrahim tells about how he arrived in Ireland in the first place. And there's a weird symmetry between the reason and how he ended up in Ireland this time, or in 2008, with how he got out of it, of Gaza this time around. Basically an evacuation under a war of a similar type. He has a huge amount of gratitude and love for this country. And I think that from what I've seen from the messages that people have sent on, there's a huge amount of love for him and his family going in the reverse direction as well. I mean, it's just an incredibly warm, unmalicious, very special family who have, you know, not an ounce of hate or revenge or anything in their body. And I'm just very happy that he's back and that he's sharing a story. And I'm happy for all of the families who have had reunions over the course of the last weekend. And hopefully there'll be more reunions to come of a different kind in the next number of days and weeks.
Finish, and we'll talk about that in a second. Like you said, there was huge interest in the clip that you're, the report that you did for Sunday evening's Virgin Media News. That's obviously on your socials, and we will put that on the podcast feed on Friday morning, that full chat that you had with Ibrahim after he got home last weekend. We mentioned reunions, and Zara, this is a very fluid situation as we're recording here on Wednesday afternoon. There are some reports circulating about which we have reason to be a little bit cautious, but obviously with the news of there being a ceasefire and prospective hostage releases, this is also going to be a very emotionally charged time.
It is. So, like, we've spoken to Tom Hand on the podcast before, and again last week we've kind of been chatting to him every week. Obviously he's hoping that Emily is going to be on the list, and at the time of recording the list has not been published. There was a list circulating throughout the afternoon, which we've gone back and spoken to multiple sources who've said that that's not the accurate list. And obviously the families are hoping as well that they will get a heads up before the list goes public. Tom has been in Ireland. He's been in New York. He's in London, sort of, you know, waiting desperately and hoping that he can, you know, see Emily very, very soon. But did have a chance to chat to him very briefly this morning about how he feels about the ceasefire and how he feels about the possibility of Emily being released. And here's what he had to say.
We can't allow ourselves to think about any deal until we see her beautiful blue eyes looking directly at me. We're still concerned about the conditions where she was kept, how much it will affect her, and for how long. We are, of course, hopeful she might be one of the first to be released because of her age, you know, between 8 and 9. But we're also prepared for that she might be one of the last.
Are you heading back to Israel now in anticipation for her release?
No, we're going to carry on with the campaign until we have absolute definite news, information, official news and information that she is being released, and then we'll fly off on the next flight. But when she's released, you know, she's going to be handed over to the Red Cross, and then from the Red Cross she'll be brought into Israel, and then when she gets into Israel, the first thing they're going to do is obviously put her in a hospital, take care of any physical conditions, and start the process of fixing her mentally. So, you know, it's going to be a long, slow process.
Do you think that this is the first time you've had any sort of hope in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, definitely. This is the best hope that we've had for a month and a half, whatever it is, I can't remember today. It's absolutely the best news. But then again, like I say, anything could go wrong between now and the release of the first hostages to the last. We've had this type of news before, you know, rumors and stuff. So we've been up high and then we get crashed down to the ground. So I've told my son and daughter and family to keep a level head. I have to stay strong with whatever method I find to give me strength and carry on.
Do we know yet when the list, or whoever, do we know who's making the list? Is it the Israelis will make the list, or Hamas, or who gets to decide who's on the list? Do we know?
I guess it would be, and I'm only guessing, it would be a combination of the Red Cross and the Hamas. They would be the only two people I believe in. There'd be no army, there'd be no government. The Red Cross is the key.
Okay. And we don't know yet when that list will be out, do we?
Possibly this afternoon. Possibly.
Okay.
If everything goes to plan, possibly this afternoon.
Okay, Tom. Well, look, I really hope that Emily's on the list and I really hope that you get to see her very, very soon. And thank you so much again for giving us another update. We do really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Zara. Thank you. Thank you for speaking.
Thanks, Tom.
So that was this morning, having a chance to talk to Tom. And I hope, by the way, that while you're watching this, that there has been an update, and I hope that she's on the list. And we will bring those updates across our social media channels as well as soon as we get it.
It is just illustrative to interrupt you, but it's illustrative at the time of recording, and that even the families involved, how fluid the situation is, where they don't know who's compiling the list. They don't know at what point it's all going to kick in. It just goes to illustrate how much of this is still yet to have the dust settle on it at the time that we're recording.
Absolutely. And it's even when he talks about how they've had so many highs and lows, you know, he talks about the fact that you have to remember this is a man who was told his daughter was dead and believed that for a number of weeks. So I think that, you know, you have to empathise and understand that Tom Hand, until he physically touches his daughter and holds her in his arms, it's very difficult for him to take on board anything else.
Hard to believe anything until you have her in front of you again, I suppose.
Yeah.
All of the situation is very fluid, but it's also very fragile as well. I think that's something we should bear in mind, as a lot of talk about, you know, just the fact that this is good news, that there is a ceasefire deal agreed, which should come into effect on Thursday morning. The terms of the deal are interesting, and this is what it is. So basically, obviously, 50 women and children currently held captive by Hamas are going to be released. In return, 150 women and children held in Israeli prisoners, they're going to be released. There'll be a four-day pause, as they say, in terms of Israeli actions in Gaza. That will also include the flying of surveillance drones over Gaza. After that point, the Israeli government has been very, very adamant that it is not the end of the war, that once the 4 days is over and there is no further exchange of prisoners, that if anything, they will intensify their efforts, which is something to keep an eye on as well. They say there'll be further humanitarian convoys and relief aid over the course of the 4 days. They'll allow people to travel south through Gaza along the Salah al-Din Road. If there is to be any further exchange of prisoners, if Hamas exchange 10 hostages, an extra 10 hostages, they buy themselves an extra day of ceasefire in Gaza as well. Interesting, as you mentioned, Gav, the fact about why is this not introduced immediately.
A lot of people might have thought, they might have woken up on Wednesday morning to push alerts from some of the news websites, and they might have heard
stayed up till half one in the morning if you were me.
Well, look, you were at a podcast award, so the adrenaline was still coursing through your veins. A lot of them will wonder, well, why would you wait 24 hours or more? You know, the talk is that it's going to be 10 a.m. local time before this actually kicks in. Why the delay?
Well, this is because of an Israeli law. And effectively what it means is an Israel published 300 names of Palestinian women and children held in their jails, many of them who have been arrested over the last number of weeks in the West Bank, which is an area of Palestine, which is, you know, seen an upsurge in violence, an upsurge in the displacement of Palestinian people in recent weeks, which has obviously not seen as much focus as Gaza.
Yes.
For obvious enough reasons. But these women and children, their names have been published. They're currently in Israeli jails. But there is a law in Israel that means that if there is to be any release of Palestinian prisoners, there is a window there for people to challenge the release of those prisoners
okay.
in the country's courts. So that is there and that is currently there. I don't know what the prospects are, and none of us really do, of somebody challenging the release of any of these prisoners, but they have a list of 300. Of course, it's 150 of those names will then go on to be released. But that's why there's no immediate ceasefire, even though the ceasefire is something that people have been calling for a long time. There's been huge international pressure. And actually, there's an interesting report. There's a really, really in-depth report on Politico, the US politics website, about how the Biden administration, the US government, fits into all this, because obviously they were one of the key facilitators of this deal. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, just an interesting nugget of information in this, is that the US government is concerned about the ceasefire in an indirect way, or at least some people in the administration are concerned about it, okay. because they believe that it'll allow more journalists into Gaza to report on everything that's happened in there, the amount of damage, the humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding there, and that that could further sour American attitudes towards Israel's actions in Gaza. But that's such an it's a very
explicit concern of theirs. Like, it's a motivating factor against
among some people who spoke off the record to Politico. That's a concern that people within the administration do have. But I think that's very interesting. I put up the link online earlier on, but it's interesting just to see how this diplomacy is happening.
I was just going to say, I do think as well, like, there's a, and you talked about it as well, Gavin, like, there is actually a fragility here, though, that the ceasefire needs to hold as well. You know what I mean? That, like, somebody can't step out of line here. You know what I mean? Like, it's, we need to understand that as much as there's a level of diplomacy here on the ground, you know, it, all it takes is one person to make a mistake and the whole thing collapses.
Yeah. And we're talking on the premise that this will be a 4-day deal, which is delivered. And you might hope that peace for 4 days becomes peace for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, that, you know, the idea of a permanent ceasefire is at least achievable if you have a momentary pause in hostilities.
But it's definitely not on the cards yet.
But you, very but much not, on the cards not only that, but you do have to deliver the 4 days first.
Yes.
Like you said, it's very
but
easy for...
But I would say that every minute of every hour of those 4 days are going to be like knife edge, you know what I mean? Really, really.
Yeah.
Well, it's worth remembering as well, that the last time that there was any proximity or feeling there was a proximity to a deal which would see a cessation of violence was literally in the hours before Israel began the land invasion of Gaza, that there was a huge amount of progress, that the Qatari side, who have been effectively the key, the people who have broached this deal, that they reported huge confidence that a deal would be struck in the coming hours, only for then it to fall apart, or apparently fall apart, and Israel to move in then with the land invasion. So there's also questions, we're having conversations outside as well, about how much of this deal is agreed by Hamas's representatives who are speaking to Qatar and Egypt in Qatar, who are based in Qatar, versus Hamas on the ground in Gaza, because there has been a disconnect at different times.
The negotiators basically have the authority, or that they can deliver on something that they're talking about in a boardroom somewhere else, and how that relates to what's going on the ground.
Yeah, and communications in Gaza is very, very difficult, as we found out multiple times.
Because you're literally talking about people being like in underground tunnels in Gaza, like, let's be honest as well, trying to communicate.
Yeah, and the mobile network has had multiple problems. The fuel there is still not getting through. Anything which is getting through is dribs and drabs. Hopefully more gets through at this point in time. But also worth bearing in mind, until we have the ceasefire, there is still bombings going on. There's still ground operations going on. There has been an intensification, actually, of airstrikes in southern Gaza, which has, of course, caused more suffering than for the ordinary people of Gaza.
There's a fair chance, if you hadn't heard the name already, of Javier Milei, that you might have heard it in the last couple of days. And to be honest, even if you haven't heard his name, you might well have seen some memes with people saying what he looks like because of his slightly unorthodox personal grooming, his sideburns, his hairdo. He's going to be a very influential man because he's just been elected as president of Argentina. And, Rich, I don't mean to be too pejorative, but the very fact that his nickname is El Loco tells you a lot about his approach to life.
Sure does. El Loco, I suppose it translates effectively as the madman, doesn't it, really? Like, Javier Milei is an eccentric character. He's one who has based his populism very much in the model of Donald Trump, but probably a little bit more madcap, if you want to go around train of mind. He's a 53-year-old man, right? Self-identified as an anarcho-capitalist. People might have seen videos of him you know, with a whiteboard of government departments and just ripping them off, saying he's going to just get rid of all these
departments.
Abolish these departments, which is an easy thing to do.
So Department of Environment and Sustainable Development, abolish. Department of Tourism, Sports, abolish.
So wait, you just feel that they're not necessary? Like, or what?
Yeah. Okay. His thing is that the government should be much smaller and just almost shouldn't
exist.
He
just wants to save a few bob by closing down a few departments. And then if there's no departments for people to come and complain, then I guess...
Well, I suppose his argument is probably that the state should be as small as it absolutely needs to be, and that if he doesn't think that there's a pressing need for the government
Isn't
to do
Argentina
these things...
Isn't Argentina quite a big country, though? No.
There'd be a case for having a lot of those things, but he obviously thinks there's a case for getting rid of them, which is why he's infamously trying to slash down all the spending, which is why people may have seen some videos of him wielding a chainsaw, the chainsaw being a very visual depiction of what he proposes to do with state spending. Give you back your money, cut taxes, cut down on state spending. Mm-hmm. That's his approach to things.
So, amongst the policies he's pushed forward, eliminating the central bank, switching the nation's currency from the Argentinian peso to the US dollar, amongst other economic measures. Yeah, yeah. He wants to get rid of the Argentinian peso.
When you say it out loud in isolation, it does sound like a pretty wild idea.
No, I'm sorry. That's not...
We're only getting started there.
Right.
We have a long way to go here.
I didn't read up on this before we started this item, so I'm excited.
We'll come back to why he's doing
that. He has also rallied against sex education in schools. He's pledged to curb abortion access and rejected climate science as a socialist conspiracy. But mostly, I think it's just his general demeanour and... oddness in a pejorative sense that people have sort of, you know, taken to him and have commentated on. You mentioned the chainsaw, for example, Gav. His relationship with his dogs is particularly noteworthy, I think.
Because the dogs, it's dogs plural, in that he has multiple dogs, but they're all
Please
clones.
Please tell me the relationship with the dogs is above board.
They are clones Seems of the be. Same dog. All Sorry? Of his dogs now are clones of his previous dog. So his dog was Conan, named after Conan the Barbarian. And he was so fond of this dog that after the aforementioned original dog died, first of all, he claims that the dog appeared to him in a dream posthumously and encouraged him to run for president of Argentina, and that this was his calling to seek the office. But since
I mean,
then,
my late dog does appear to me in dreams sometimes. But I mean,
does he pass you on
no,
political messages?
He does not. Nope.
There's no like nope. heraldic, poetic ashlings in
no.
your dream telling you what to do.
No.
He's had the dog cloned multiple times, so his pets. Are all the same dog.
Like genetically?
Genetically.
He also claims that he met his dog Conan, named after Conan the Barbarian, 2,000 years ago when he was a gladiator in Rome.
This is not real.
And that the
real.
Pair did not fight because they were destined to join forces in the future, which he says he took as a portent of his future presidential run alongside Conan
this
the
Dog. This man is running Argentina.
He will be from the 5th of December.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
The idea about abolishing the currency, like you were aghast at that. You were like,
I thought it couldn't get worse than that, but incidentally it has actually.
Well, the reason for his thinking is that Argentina is in the middle of like runaway hyperinflation. Like it's almost at the point of like, you know, 90s Zimbabwe or 1930s Germany. Like it's completely fallen to bits. Like the inflation rate this year is projected to be somewhere in the region of 140%. So
wow.
when you think about how quickly money is devaluing,
yeah.
there's a real problem there. And lots of other Latin and Southern American countries have had that experience over time. Like if your currency is just cratering in value, how do you level it off? Brazil had loads of different experiments which resulted in them having two different currencies in parallel at the same time. And they introduced one to be stable and then abolished the other. His idea is rather than doing all of that, just adopt the US dollar. Just decide instead of having a loaf of bread that might be 100 pesos today and 150 tomorrow and 200 the day after, just charge it in dollars. Just get rid, abolish the country's central bank because again, smaller government, and just use the US dollar instead. Which is a...
Is it going full circle back to genius or where are we at with that?
There is a rationale for it. It is untested in a country of this size that you'd basically just outsource all... fiscal policy, because like, okay, granted, he might say this is the best way to rescue the Argentinian economy, but if you peg yourself to another currency, or if you basically make yourself entirely dependent on that, if America were mismanaged at some time in the future and the value of the dollar disappears, then you just end up importing the same problem with no ability to influence the solution.
Right.
Mm. So it's a tricky thing to get right, but it is also interesting, Richard, from the perspective that there was this narrative or this feeling that the tide had gone out on the far right and that leaders like that had their day. The defeat of Bolsonaro.
Trump is leading the polls again. I think that would have been premature if people did think that the threat of far right
Had gone away.
You know, had gone away. Just a couple more Mille.
Oh, thank you.
Bits sorry, there's more.
Yeah. There's a few more
there
bits.
There's always more.
He's described Pope Francis, of course, a hero in his native Argentina, as a filthy leftist and an imbecile. He has hailed American gangster Al Capone as a hero.
Spicy.
He
Al
also...
Capone's a hero.
Yeah.
Al Capone.
He wants people to be able to sell their own vital organs as a way of raising capital for themselves. He describes all his dogs as his children and his best strategists. And that he does take political advice.
Well, one of them is clearly his political doyen or his maven, his muse.
His dog.
So. He's also, he's unmarried. He has a girlfriend, but he says he suggested that his sister might be his first lady because she ran his campaign for him. So yeah, look, he's
weird.
He's
weird.
He's been well. His victory has been celebrated and hailed by the likes of Bolsonaro and by the likes of Donald Trump, who's described himself as being very proud that Mr. Milei has ended up in the highest office in the land in Argentina. But it does speak to just the corrosive nature of politics like this can be that it will further erode trust in the political system. That, again, it leads to this view that there is a deep state of civil servants and judges there who are there to be rooted out and that they're against the interests of the vast majority of the public and that there's only a one-man saviour who can go in there and rip them out and uproot them. And that's something we've seen before and we've seen multiple times and it is something which...
But the bottom line here is that somebody voted for him. People voted for him.
55
big numbers, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. So, I mean, like... That's a bigger lesson in how people are feeling and thinking. You know what I mean? That's a clear message from the voters there that they... I mean, I suppose a lot of voters I find, and you know, you find it yourself when you cover elections, like the thing that people will say, no matter which election it is, time after time, they'll say they want change, they want change, they want change. Mm-hmm. And whether that change can be delivered by the, you know, sitting parties that are currently in government or whether it has to be brand new to get change, change is always the key word. But that's quite an extreme.
Yeah.
That's quite an extreme move for change.
Yeah, you just found another part of his manifesto.
Oh God,
you
he found another fact.
He has previously signalled Ireland as a country he would like to model Argentina on.
Yes.
It's a Celtic miracle, he told The Economist back in September.
He's never been here.
It was one of the most miserable countries in Europe, and today it's one of the best in Europe, with a GDP per capita of 120,000.
Yeah, well, he's not trying to rent a two-bed semi-D in Dublin.
Exactly, yeah.
Probably could on the salary he's going to inherit now. But no, you're right, like he did. He won pretty comfortably. It was 55%
to 45%. People put him there, is what I'm saying.
And he defeated the guy who was the existing finance minister in the last government. So it really was a case of like continuity versus change. And people quite clearly, materially did decide change, which is even more remarkable because Argentina is one of those countries that has a first round and then a runoff. So if nobody gets 50% first time, they bring the top two forward. And the like first time around, he was beaten. That the outgoing finance minister, a guy who was Sergio Massa, beat him fairly comfortably in the first round. So everyone thought, oh, well, this will be a novelty, but he's surely not going to win second time around if he got outpolled. But clearly, he just hoovered up all of this anti-government sentiment. And now he's been driven in with this massive mandate and this massive opportunity to do some pretty remarkable things on the back of it.
But surely when we look at, say, common sense prevailing, right? I just want to say this. Surely, this is sort of an example, a warning shot of how, you know, maybe it's not always, change is not always, you know, be careful what you wish for is what I'm trying to say. Like surely, you know, when you end up with a leader in your country who is citing their dog as their best political advisor, you might look back at the old ballot box and think to yourself, things went a bit awry there.
There is that argument as well that people get tamed when they end up in the actual office.
Yeah.
You campaign as being a loco and when you end up there, you find things are a little bit more difficult. I will say just further research on this man over the last couple of minutes. Javier Milei, who has an image consultant, which is shocking in itself.
If you've seen pictures of Javier Milei, that in itself is remarkable.
Well, to give you a picture, if you haven't seen him, his image consultant conceived his unorthodox hairdo as being a cross between Elvis Presley and Wolverine from the X-Men.
He does look Wolverine gone into retirement.
Yeah, it says Wolverine is very loyal and brave and he can get really mad and aggressive just like Javier.
Well, the one closing thought then is that I just presumed that was a natural look that had been fermented over time, but if a consultant came up with this combination of quiff and pointy sideburns, maybe it suggests that he is open to some outside thinking and that maybe he might be softened down by the practicalities of having to run the country. But we'll see, because it'll be an interesting petri dish for how it's possible to run a government by trying to slim down.
Yeah, well, I think slim down is even almost the most polite way of putting it. Yeah. Like this is
dismantling.
You're looking at the Trump model and the Bolsonaro model and potentially putting it on steroids, effectively, in terms of what Milei pushes forward. And it is, as you say, Gavin, it is a sign that that level of populism and that particular firebrand level of
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Populism, that is certainly not dead.
It seems like the sort of thing that's been discussed for ages, but it's remarkable that we're one of the only countries in the EU that doesn't do it, at least up until now. There are now finally plans underway to link unemployment assistance to the income that you had before you got laid off. So we're presently, right now, everyone in the country gets a flat rate of €220, maybe more if you've got dependent children, that in future, the amount of dole you get, at least for a few months, will be linked to how much you previously earned. The thinking being that if you're on an average full-time salary, 47 or 48,000 euro a year, the idea of suddenly being asked to live on €220 a week is a bit unthinkable, and that they need to soften it down. What do you think of it? And are you surprised it's taken this long to come around to?
First of all, I think it's quite a good idea, obviously, in terms of, you know, supporting people through a difficult time. And it's incremental, isn't it? So it's 3 months. It's the first 3 months.
Yeah, 3 months would be capped at 450 a week, then 375, okay, and then 300. And then only after 9 months, you drop down to the baseline rate.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, like, we've talked many times about the cost of living on this podcast. We talked about how much it's costing people to rent, to live, to fund everything, you know, losing your job. If you're living paycheck to paycheck, you end up finding yourself probably very vulnerable to homelessness and vulnerable to, like, you know, your life really collapsing. So I think it's certainly a welcome idea. I mean, I'm surprised it hasn't come up before now. Why now?
I think that there's, you know, that old shanukle of, like, ni hel on the green and on the sculp, like, basically don't go thatching the roof on a windy day. They basically do it while things are generally leveled off. I think there's an attitude that now that the public finances are relatively stable and also unemployment is pretty low, like it's at 4.8%, which is like almost statistically zero. There's very few people who are out of work and who are unable to find work. The thinking is, let's do it now rather than at a time where unemployment is already at 6, 7 or 8%. There's a lot of people falling out of work and then you find yourself with a higher bill. Now, of course, conversely, that means that if there's suddenly some economic bad day somewhere in the future, some rainy day where you have a bit like 2008, 9, 10, tens of thousands of people losing their job every week, the bill on the state could be pretty significant if that were to happen again. But I think the reason why they're doing it now is like, well, let's introduce it while it ostensibly doesn't cost us much and hope that if there is ever a rainy day, that it's a more gradual one rather than the car crash that it was in 2008, 9, 10.
Yeah, it's interesting. What's the general feeling around parties in the Dáil about whether or not they'd support this?
Well, everyone seems in favour of the idea. What was interesting, and I don't know whether this was just a case of him not being fully briefed on it, but this was announced by Heather Humphreys on Monday. Well, sorry, it was announced on Monday that she would be bringing it to Cabinet on Tuesday, which means they got to announce it twice. I was at a press do with Ona Brin that afternoon. Granted, he's not the social protection spokesman, but I said, listen, what do you make of this idea of linking your income to previous earnings? And he said, oh, we'll have to look at the detail. Which, fair enough, okay, the devil is in the detail, but most of the detail was already out. And Sinn Féin previously have called for there to be a link between unemployment benefits and the likes and the amount that you previously earned. And of course, right now there's unemployment assistance and benefit, and the benefit is slightly higher. So if you've paid more PRSI, you kind of get it that way anyway. I think there's almost universal agreement about it. So I don't think it'll be terribly long in getting through Leinster House when it does come. It's just been something that's been in the works for so long that actually kind of legislating for it or actually sort of putting it on the books might be something that takes a little bit longer. Actually, on a related note, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon and it was confirmed on Wednesday lunchtime. This follows up from something we were discussing a couple of weeks ago, actually. Do you remember we were talking about that all-party Oireachtas support about raising the pension age to 75?
Yeah.
Government says we're keeping that at 66.
Stunned.
Right.
Which, just as we predicted they would.
Which in itself is significant because do you remember they were talking about raising it to 67 and 68? And like we were all on the beat for the last general election. Mm-hmm. It became a huge election issue.
Massive,
because the plan was to raise it over time to 68. Now they're saying, no, not doing that. And they're going to fund it by making very small increases to PAYE, or PRSI rather, which will cost about €1 a week, but that they reckon if they basically do that to every taxpayer that you eventually sort of get the money back. I'm a little bit surprised almost that the big solution to something which dominated the last election was just kind of snuck out there in leaders' questions on a Wednesday afternoon and no one sort of having this big hoo-ha about what's going on.
I was like, a week is a long time in politics. That was a couple of years ago. And I think the cycle changes. And, you know, even when you come closer to election, there'll be things that'll have happened in the run-up to that that will become big election issues that maybe they drift off the agenda again. I do, like the point you make earlier, though, about the fact that, you know, if there was to be a mass layoff of the population, you know, if there was to be another crash, like it's hard to see how they would sustain that. Even if you think back to, say, what was the name of the payment everyone got during COVID? Oh my God.
The pandemic unemployment
payment.
That was the prompt
payment
for this.
Yeah.
Because, do you remember when that came in and then it was tiered? It was sort of somewhat linked to what your previous salary was.
Yeah.
Basically, they've acknowledged that's a meritocracy idea. That's why they should do this now.
Okay.
That's where the ideas sort of come from.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's also obviously a lot of navel gazing about Stephen Kenny, which we're not going to go into here, but there was that is unfortunately, obviously, to some degree, Richard, overshadowed some of the navel gazing that there was in the aftermath of last Sunday's FAI Women's Cup final, which took place in Tala under a crowd which unfortunately didn't come anywhere near matching the crowd that was at the men's match previously.
Sure.
Some really impassioned comments afterwards from the manager of the winning team from Athlone.
No, he's the chairman of the club, Michael O'Connor. Okay. And he was just talking about how the sports minister will turn up at anything. Will turn up at events, you know, promoting women's sport and men's sport. We'll go over to the Women's World Cup, for example. But it was very, very strange indeed that there was no representative from the government at the FAI Women's Cup final, particularly as we're having, you know, this timeline where we're promoting women's football. We're trying to encourage, you know, attendance at women's football. There was no statement or there was no attendance by the sports minister at that.
So neither Catherine Martin nor Thomas Byrne were in Thala for that, despite all and sundry being in the Aviva the week previously.
No, and the game itself was great. There was a great penalty shootout in there, which is always fun when it descends to the pure chaos penalty shootout. It's always better when Shells lose finals as well. Very enjoyable. So I think I was pretty happy with that.
Bose fan of the
well, do, well done to Athlone Town. Well deserved. Great scenes at the homecoming as well, actually, which is very nice to see. But it is. It comes obviously the weekend after the FAI, the Men's Cup final at Lansdowne Road with the biggest attendance on record for a domestic football game here. So there's clearly an upswell in interest in the domestic game in this country. It is not being matched in terms of political will and financial support that Michael O'Connor, in what he was saying as the Athlone Town chairman, saying, you know, this is amazing what's happening in our leagues, both men's and women's, in terms of fans travelling around the country, seeing Irish talent coming through and making their way into the international setups as well. But there's no funding there. He said in his words that we are drowning in Irish football domestically, that the support isn't there, that you're seeing money going to greyhound racing, horse racing, GA, women's GA. And of course, he made the point as well that he wasn't begrudging any of these sports having financial supports. But football is in every community in this country. It is the easiest sport to take part in terms of equipment and whatnot.
Yeah.
It just needs a little bit of a leg up. And at a time when people are moaning and griping about what's happening with the senior men's international team, rightly so, the results have been very, very poor. We are seeing probably the end of Stephen Kenny as the Ireland manager. There is a deep-rooted problem now because of a lack of investment and a lack of support for our domestic game. And it's like you're having people, whether they be politicians, sitting around in the Dáil bar afterwards scratching their head and, oh, why is the Ireland team no good anymore? We used to be pretty good. And it's like, well, maybe you guys should, you know, get up off your backsides and put money into the sport.
What I think is mad about all of this, not that any of that is illegitimate, but I think it's mad that people have cause to complain about that in what should be such a marquee year for women's soccer. Like, the biggest sporting event of the summer was the women's team qualifying for the World Cup for the first time. Everyone remembers what they were doing when they saw Katie McCabe's corner go in against Canada. And that this idea then that suddenly you go home and it should be this rosy period where everyone is suddenly obsessed with what's going on. Like, there's a big set piece occasion. It's not part of a double header with the men's final like it used to be. Standalone occasion where you can go and enjoy the thing and enjoy the game on its own merits. And not alone, no ministers, but also the fact that even after such a boon for women's soccer that was, the money's not coming.
So like that term fine day supporter kind of rings a bell, doesn't it? It's that idea that like, you know, when the World Cup was on and all that, that everyone was willing to rally around, and now that the dust has settled on that, so it's just not the same.
No, I think it's more, I think there's probably an element of it that people haven't associated themselves with clubs as of yet in terms of women's football in the grand sort of general public sense. Like people will have come across, you know.
What do you mean like that idea of membership, pride of place, participation? Like,
yeah, I think so. I think you're seeing it happen more in England now where support and attendance is at the domestic games there is going up. You're seeing more games happening now in the men's Premier League stadiums.
Yeah.
So in Stamford Bridge, Old Trafford, there's women's...
The Man United and Man City women's teams played in Old Trafford last
exactly.
Sunday.
And they're getting good attendances because the clubs themselves are promoting the women's teams, and because there's such a groundswell behind, you know, the Lionesses, the English national team there, that it's feeding through into, well, I want to watch football every week. I want to watch women's football every week. There's a great infrastructure and culture around the women's league there. That just hasn't grown up yet. There is some really good stuff happening.
Do you think it'll come then? That if it is the case that the associated women's teams to the traditional men's clubs do flourish, that it'll come from that?
Yeah, I hope so. But like, I mean, at the same time, like, there isn't a huge amount of attendance at, you know, inter-county camogie and Gaelic football matches in the women's games at this point in time as well, neither in provincial women's rugby as well. And all these things, we see that there is an attendance, and there is there for All-Ireland finals in these things, or for Ireland internationals in the women's games. And of course now for the women's soccer team, you know, selling out very regularly. They should probably be moving their matches full time to the Aviva, given what's happening. But it's just generally speaking, we're not seeing enough support there. And I think that's something which is going to take time to fix, because it's a bigger, bigger problem in Irish soccer.
Before we go, time to check in on all of our various Netflix habits, which is obviously the first half of season 6 of The Crown.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of dreadful. Sorry, I don't know whether we can say the two words shorthand, because it might be a bit of a spoiler about... so it deals with the death of Princess Diana.
It's not a spoiler. I mean, it's real, you know.
No, but that some of the way in which...
That would be a spoiler for...
Princess Diana died. Like, it's not
not the fact that she died. That was 26 years ago. That's fact. The bit about how that's portrayed and how there are some...
Oh, who cares?
...appearances. All right, you know what? If you're watching this... Okay, sorry. Turn it off now if you don't want a spoiler.
Yeah.
Ghost Diana appears in a couple of episodes.
So, like, I thoroughly enjoyed The Crown, loved it, saw the first few episodes, rattled through them, actually thought it was very good. Thought the actress who plays Diana is definitely the best Diana I've seen, as in, you know, because there's been people who've played Diana over the years, and I just think that they haven't really managed to get her in terms of, you know, the nuances and the facial expressions. This girl is brilliant. This woman is brilliant at playing Diana. I will say that. And I actually thought it was really, really good. I thought it was really well done, apart from the moment when they have Diana appear as a ghost speaking to Charles on the jet back from France. And they're sort of having this kind of, you know, moment of reconciliation, and you weren't all that bad and you weren't all that bad. And I'm like, what? That never happened. Like, it literally never happened. And I understand that some things and some conversations will be, you know, changed to some degree. But like, ghost Diana literally did not appear to Charles to anyone's knowledge. So I don't know where this came.
And then
like,
ghost
Dodie Al-Fayed talking to his father. I was kind of going... It was all going so well. And then I just thought, what is this?
Well, we don't know, it didn't happen for certain.
Yeah.
But
okay.
But I do wonder, though, like, is it possibly the case that they took this amount of dramatic license?
But who told the writers of The Crown that Ghost Diana appeared to him?
Isn't it possible that, like, people are complaining now because they sort of almost perceived The Crown as being almost like historical documentary because they hadn't lived through
the stuff. People do watch these things and they take these things on.
Yeah.
As, like, it does influence how they view the figures that they portray.
Because if you didn't live through the first couple of series of if you're not 90 years old and you have no first-hand memory of all the stuff that involved Elizabeth for the first couple of seasons, you're looking at that and you think, oh, that must be how it went down.
Who's this girl boss queen? Like, you know, that's what it is.
Who's this girl boss queen?
But I put this on the run in order because, like, there's a backlash against Ghost Diana, understandably. There's also a backlash against Ridley Scott's Napoleon, where Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon fires cannons at the pyramids of Egypt, which is something that doesn't happen.
Sorry, did that happen in real life?
No, it didn't. No, it did. Ridley Scott says it's just to signify how he captured Egypt, so he just shot the pyramids. So I don't know, but there's a broader conversation. It's just a broader conversation now that these things, which are based around historical events, like how important is it that they are at least somewhat true to life?
I mean, it's quite important, I would say.
I'm a big fan of Ghost Diana.
You're not a big fan of Ghost Diana.
I'm a big
fan.
You're
just saying it. You're
a big fan.
He's just saying it to annoy me now.
She does a great bashful eye, to be fair.
I want more ghost characters.
But I would say that I do think that for the most part, there were good, like, I actually felt that it was the most, not most accurate, but I felt it was the most likely to be real until the ghost section. Like, I've watched every documentary about the royal family. I have watched every interview Diana ever gave. Like, I've watched all these things multiple times over and over again. I've no problem saying that. And I did think that this was very good up until the ghost moment.
Was there not a problem? There's some backlash or some criticism about the portrayal of Dodi Al-Fayed and the Muhammad Al-Fayed thing, that it was a bit, that it makes them into this.
Yeah.
So it's portrayed that Muhammad sort of engineered the whole thing.
Yeah.
He was engaged to another woman, and that this relationship was basically engineered by Muhammad for social climbing, or that ultimately that he'd have some diplomatic pressure.
Yeah, that's strongly denied by people in that camp.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does portray it like that. Yeah, no, it does. Yeah,
But is that like
slightly problematic? I would say, yeah.
Well, it's problematic if it's not true, and that it's not fair to kind of besmirch people.
Well, like, exactly, and I mean, it kind of goes back to like the difference between fact and fiction. You know what I mean? It's a fiction based on fact, but it's not.
But if you're watching a Netflix series like this, are you actually looking for
historical
docudrama?
Yeah,
but I think you have there's an element of duty you do have to not completely
destroy a person.
Yeah, and just not like make people believe absolutely insane things. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because people are impressionable. People's depiction, like the Michael Collins film, for example, that did colour people's perceptions of Eamon de Valera, for example.
Yeah.
People had, and there was, you know, a lot of historical really
Well, when you're portrayed by Snape and the guy from
The greatest baddie of all time. Yeah. He's great.
And the man who cheated on your woman in Love Actually.
Yeah, just serial baddie.
I've never
so, but it, these things do matter. These things do matter because it does influence how people see these people. So it's a bit of responsibility there. I'm all for poetic and artistic license. I'm all for Ghost Diana, as I say. And long may they continue to make it. I hope she makes many repeat appearances in the Christmas version of season six of The Crown. Best wishes
in the Crown's Christmas special.
I do have to tell you before we go, because you'll enjoy this. You know, we laugh about how I don't delete emails.
Correct.
Well, Richard has spent the morning trying to help me unblock my inbox.
I'm trying to do mine as well, actually.
Well, yours is actually, but mine's worse than his. 12 days I haven't received an email in.
Mine is now actually better than
yours is actually just slightly
better. No, mine's worse now than yours, sorry, because you fixed
yours. But I've improved mine since before we came in here. I've deleted
yours. Yours is only better because Richard has taken taken a Javier Milei chainsaw.
Yeah, well, yours is just not working, whereas you helped me to fix mine, but yours isn't working.
Mine is yet to be repaired.
Yeah. What's your current count for WhatsApp unreads?
My unread WhatsApp conversations.
Last time it was in the low 300s. What do you know?
387.
That's worse.
Oh, it is. No. Well, it's slightly worse. That's all.
No, it's quite a bit worse.
If you text me and I don't text you back, no, it's not personal.
And if
you're
you email
in the same bracket with everyone else.
And if you email her, she's just not going to get it.
You just get a bounce back.
Thanks to everyone involved in putting the whole thing together. Neve in the gallery, Neve on the floor, Aubrey, Rory, Ross, Tommy, everyone else who's been involved in putting the whole thing together. Thank you, Zara. Thank you, Richard. We will see you again same time next week. Until then, cheerio.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.